Chapter 40. You talk together a lot? I pursued my inquiries. He mostly let me talk to her, confessed Mr. Powell. Don't know that she was very much interested, but still she let me. She never cut me short. All the sympathies of Mr. Powell were for Flora Anthony Needabarrel. She was the only human being younger than himself on board that ship since the Ferndale carried no boys, and was manned by a full crew of able seamen. Yes. Their youth had created a sort of bond between them. Mr. Powell's open countenance must have appeared to her distinctly pleasing amongst the mature, rough, crabbed or even inimical faces she saw around her. With the warm generosity of his age, young Powell was on her side, as it were, even before he knew that there were sides to be taken on board that ship, and what this taking sides was about. There was a girl. A nice girl. He asked himself no questions. Flora Debarrel was not so much younger in years than himself, but for some reason, perhaps by contrast with the accepted idea of a captain's wife, he could not regard her otherwise but as an extremely youthful creature. At the same time, apart from her exalted position, she exercised over him the supremacy a woman's earlier maturity gives her over a young man of her own age. As a matter of fact, we can see that, without ever having more than a half an hour's consecutive conversation together, and the distances duly preserved, these two were becoming friends under the eye of the old man, I suppose. How he first got in touch with his captain's wife, Powell relates in this way. It was long before his memorable conversation with the mate and shortly after getting clear of the channel. It was gloomy weather, deadhead wind, blowing quite half a gale. The Ferndale, under reduced sail, was stretching close-hauled across the track of the homeward-bound ships, just moving through the water and no more, since there was no object in pressing her, and the weather looked threatening. About 10 o'clock at night he was alone on the poop, in charge, keeping well aft by the weather rail and staring to windward, when amongst the white, breaking seas, under the black sky, he made out the lights of a ship. He watched them for some time. She was running dead before the wind, of course. She will pass jolly close, he said to himself, and then suddenly he felt a great mistrust of that approaching ship. She's heading straight for us, he thought. It was not his business to get out of the way. On the contrary. And his uneasiness grew by the recollection of the 40 tons of dynamite in the body of the Ferndale. Not the sort of cargo one thinks of with equanimity in connection with a threatened collision. He gazed at the two small lights in the dark immensity filled with the angry noise of the seas. They fascinated him till their plainness to his sight gave him a conviction that there was danger there. He knew in his mind what to do in the emergency, but very properly he felt that he must call the captain out at once. He crossed the deck in one bound. By the immemorial custom and usage of the sea, the captain's room is on the starboard side. You would just as soon expect your captain to have his nose at the back of his head as to have his stateroom on the port side of the ship. Powell forgot all about the direction on that point given him by the chief. He flew over, as I said, stamped with his foot, and then putting his face to the cowl of the big ventilator shouted down there, "Please come on deck, sir," in a voice which was not trembling or scared but which we may call fairly expressive. There could not be a mistake as to the urgence of the call, but instead of the expected alert LL right and the sound of a rush down there, he heard only a faint exclamation, then silence. Think of his astonishment. He remained there, his ear in the cowl of the ventilator, his eyes fastened on those menacing sidelights dancing on the gusts of wind which swept the angry darkness of the sea. It was as though he had waited an hour, but it was something much less than a minute, before he fairly bellowed into the wide tube, "Captain Anthony." An agitated, "had it?" was what he heard down there in Mrs. Anthony's voice, light rapid footsteps. Why didn't she try to wake him up? "Want the captain," he shouted, then gave it up, making a dash at the companion, where a blue light was kept, resolved to act for himself. On the way he glanced at the helmsman whose face lighted up by the binnacle lamps was calm. He said rapidly to him, "Stand by to spin that helm up at the first word." The answer, "Ye, aye, sir," was delivered in a steady voice. Then Mr. Powell, after a shout for the watch on deck to aft, ran to the ship's side and struck the blue light on the rail. A sort of nasty little spitting of sparks was all that came. The light, perhaps affected by damp, had failed to ignite. The time of all these various acts must be counted in seconds. Powell confessed to me that at this failure he experienced a paralysis of thought, of voice, of limbs. The unexpectedness of this misfire positively overcame his faculties. It was the only thing for which his imagination was not prepared. It was knocked clean over. When it got up, it was with the suggestion that he must do something at once, or there would be a broadside smash accompanied by the explosion of dynamite, in which both ships would be blown up, and every soul on board of them would vanish off the earth in an enormous flame and uproar. He saw the catastrophe happening, and at the same moment, before he could open his mouth or stir a limb, to ward off the vision, a voice very near his ear, the measured voice of Captain Anthony, said, "Wouldn't light, eh? Throw it down. Jump for the flare-up." The spring of activity in Mr. Powell was released with great force. He jumped. The flare-up was kept inside the companion with a box of matches ready to hand. Almost before he knew he had moved, he was diving under the companion slide. He got hold of the can in the dark, and tried to strike a light. But he had to press the flare holder to his breast with one arm, his fingers were damp and stiff, his hands trembled a little. One match broke. Another went out. In its flame he saw the colorless face of Mrs. Anthony a little below him, standing on the cabin stairs. Her eyes, which were very close to his, he was in a crouching posture on the top step, seemed to burn darkly in the vanishing light. On deck the captain's voice was heard, sudden and unexpectedly sardonic. "Who had better look sharp, if you want to be in time?" "Let me have the box," said Mrs. Anthony in a hurried and familiar whisper which sounded amused, as if they had been a couple of children up to some lark behind a wall. He was glad of the offer, which seemed to him very natural, and without ceremony, "Here you are. Catch hold." Their hands touched in the dark, and she took the box, while he held the paraffin-soaked torch in its iron holder. He thought of warning her, "Look out for yourself." But before he had the time to finish the sentence, the flare blazed up violently between them, and he saw her throw herself back with an arm across her face. "Hello," he exclaimed. Only he could not stop a moment to ask if she was hurt. He bolted out of the companion straight into his captain, who took the flare from him and held it high above his head. The fierce flame fluttered like a silk flag, throwing an angry swaying glare mingled with moving shadows over the poop, lighting up the concave surfaces of the sails, gleaming on the wet paint of the white rails. And young Powell turned his eyes to windward with a catch in his breath. The strange ship, a darker shape in the night, did not seem to be moving onwards, but only to grow more distinct right abeam, staring at the Ferndale with one green and one red eye which swayed and tossed, as if they belonged to the restless head of some invisible monster ambushed in the night amongst the waves. A moment, long like eternity, elapsed, and suddenly, the monster, which seemed to take to itself the shape of a mountain, shut its green eye without as much as a preparatory wink. Mr. Powell drew a free breath. "LL right now," said Captain Anthony in a quiet undertone. He gave the blazing flare to Powell, and walked aft to watch the passing of that menace of destruction coming blindly with its parti-colored stare out of a blind night on the wings of a sweeping wind. Her very form could be distinguished now, black and elongated amongst the hissing patches of foam bursting along her path. As is always the case with a ship running before wind and sea, she did not seem to an onlooker to move very fast, but to be progressing indolently in long leisurely bounds and pauses in the midst of the overtaking waves. It was only when actually passing the stern with an easy hail of the Ferndale that her headlong speed became apparent to the eye. With the red light shut off, and soaring like an immense shadow on the crest of a wave, she was lost to view in one great forward swing, melting into the lightless space. "Close shave," said Captain Anthony in an indifferent voice just raised enough to be heard in the wind. "Blind lot on board that ship. Put out the flare now." Silently Mr. Powell inverted the holder, smothering the flame in the can, bringing about by the mere turn of his wrist the fall of darkness upon the poop, and at the same time vanished out of his mind's eye the vision of another flame enormous and fierce shooting violently from a white-churned patch of the sea, lighting up the very clouds and carrying upwards in its volcanic rush flying spars, corpses, the fragments of two destroyed ships. It vanished and there was an immense relief. He told me he did not know how scared he had been, not generally but of that very thing his imagination had conjured, till it was all over. He measured it, for fear is a great tension, by the feeling of slack weariness which came over him all at once. He walked to the companion and, stooping low to put the flare in its usual place, saw in the darkness the motionless pale oval of Mrs. Anthony's face. She whispered quietly, "Is anything going to happen? What is it?" "It's all over now," he whispered back. He remained bent low, his head inside the cover, staring at that white ghostly oval. He wondered as he had not rushed out on deck, as he had remained quietly there. This was pluck. Wonderful self-restraint. And it was not stupidity on her part. She knew there was imminent danger, and probably had some notion of its nature. "You stayed here waiting for what would come," he murmured admiringly. "Wasn't that the best thing to do?" she asked. He didn't know. Perhaps. He confessed he could not have done it. Not he. His flesh and blood could not have stood it. He would have felt he must see what was coming. Then he remembered that the flare might have scorched her face, and expressed his concern. "A bit. Nothing to hurt. Smell the singed hair?" There was a sort of gaiety in her tone. She might have been frightened, but she certainly was not overcome, and suffered from no reaction. This confirmed and augmented, if possible, Mr. Powell's good opinion of her as a Ollie girl, though it seemed to him positively monstrous to refer in such terms to one's captain's wife. "But she doesn't look it," he thought in extenuation, and was going to say something more to her about the lighting of that flare, when another voice was heard in the companion, saying some indistinct words. Its tone was contemptuous. It came from below, from the bottom of the stairs. It was a voice in the cabin, and the only other voice which could be heard in the main cabin at this time of the evening was the voice of Mrs. Anthony's father. The indistinct white oval sank from Mr. Powell's sight so swiftly as to take him by surprise. For a moment he hung at the opening of the companion, and now that her slight form was no longer obstructing the narrow and winding staircase, the voices came up louder, but the words were still indistinct. The old gentleman was excited about something, and Mrs. Anthony was aneging him, as Powell expressed it. They moved away from the bottom of the stairs, and Powell went away from the companion. Yet he fancied he had heard the words, "Us to me," before he withdrew his head. They had been uttered by Mr. Smith. Captain Anthony had not moved away from the taffrail. He remained in the very position he took up to watch the other ship go, by rolling and swinging all shadowy in the uproar of the following seas. He stirred not, and Powell, keeping nearby, did not dare speak to him, so enigmatical in its contemplation of the night did his figure appear to his young eyes. Indistinct and in its immobility, staring into gloom, the prey of some incomprehensible grief, longing or regret. Why is it that the stillness of a human being is often so impressive, so suggestive of evil, as if our proper fate were a ceaseless agitation? The stillness of Captain Anthony became almost intolerable to his second officer. Mr. Powell, loitering about the skylight, wanted his captain off the deck now. "Why doesn't he go below?" he asked himself impatiently. He ventured a cough. Whether the effect of the cough or not, Captain Anthony spoke. He did not move the least bit. With his back remaining turned to the whole length of the ship, he asked Mr. Powell with some brusqueness, if the chief mate had neglected to instruct him that the captain was to be found on the port side. Yes, sir, said Mr. Powell approaching his back. He mate told me to stamp on the port side when I wanted you, but I didn't remember at the moment. You should remember, the captain uttered with an effort. Then added mumbling, don't want Mrs. Anthony frightened. Don't you see? Dot, dot, she wasn't this time, Powell said innocently. He lighted the flare up for me, sir. This time, Captain Anthony exclaimed and turned round. Mrs. Anthony lighted the flare? Mrs. Anthony, dot, Powell explained, that she was in the companion all the time. All the time, repeated the captain. It seemed queer to Powell that instead of going himself to see the captain should ask him. Is she there now? Powell said that as he had gone below after the ship had passed clear of the Ferndale. Captain Anthony made a movement towards the companion himself when Powell added the information. Mr. Smith called to Mrs. Anthony from the saloon, sir. I believe they are talking there now. He was surprised to see the captain give up the idea of going below after all. He began to walk the poop instead regardless of the cold, of the damp wind, and of the sprays. And yet he had nothing on but his sleeping suit and slippers. Powell, placing himself on the break of the poop, kept a lookout. When after some time he turned his head to steal a glance at his eccentric captain, he could not see his active and shadowy figure swinging to and fro. The second mate of the Ferndale walked aft peering about and addressed the seaman who steered. Captain gone below? Yes, sir, said the fellow who with a quid of tobacco bulging out his left cheek kept his eyes on the compass card. His minute. He laughed. Laughed, repeated Powell incredulously. Oh, you mean the captain did? You must be mistaken. What would he want to laugh for? Don't know, sir. The elderly sailor displayed a profound indifference towards human emotions. However, after a longish pause, he conceded a few words more to the second officer's weakness. S. He was walking the deck as usual, when suddenly he laughed a little and made for the Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.